And let's get away from throwing huge weight on our spine. Mm. Squats, like normal squats or hand cleans, I don't see the point of it. I look at these goalies like Ryan Miller, Sergei Bobrovsky, Andrei Vasilevsky. They're not jacked monsters. They're not going to be on GQ with their shirts off with six packs. They're limber, they're pliable, they're mobile, and they have longevity. Listening is such a skill that not many people know how to do. Before I entered this program and still to this point, like, I have my answer ready to go before the other person's done talking. I've probably done it on this podcast already. Listening is hard. Hearing someone is hard. Not just what they're saying, but what they're not saying, what they're trying to say. There's so much nuance in there. So being an active listener, there's books on it. You may think it's a pretty simple thing, like, hey, don't talk and open your ears. Well, no, it's a lot deeper than that.
Whether it's journal, right? You know, if you're talking to Adam, a young Adam Mercer who's 14 years old, and what can we, based on this conversation, how can we take these kind of thoughts and put them into practice? Excited today to have Michael Condon, aka Condo, as our guest for today's podcast. I'm going to read this off to you. Condo, Mike, has 129 NHL games played, 64 AHL games played, 47 East Coast League games played. That's a true professional, someone that's, you know, taken the stairs, done things the right way. Worked all the way from Princeton University through the minor leagues to an exciting time for the Montreal Canadiens. A quick stop in Pittsburgh, off to Ottawa. And what strikes me about your career, Mike, is that you were always a no stone unturned kind of guy. There are guys that show up to the rink in their flip-flops. They skate, they practice, and then they go out to lunch with the guys, and that's their day. And there are other guys that get to the rink at 8 o'clock in the morning, and they get back to their apartment or house at 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon on practice days. And you were that guy, and you were always struck me as you were always looking for ways, whether it was a mental way or a physical way, to get better. And I wanted to thank you for joining us. First off, welcome you. And we're going to hop into that. So, well, welcome to the podcast, Condo.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Happy to be here.
So I'm going to start right off the bat with, I know that you found the float tank and you got some value from that. And I thought it'd be really interesting for our listeners to hear about some of the different things that you've done. So let's start with the float tank and tell me why did you go for the float tank and why did you think that was a good modality for you?
Yeah. First and foremost, preparation was kind of like my safety blanket. So I needed to feel that I prepared for an event in order to have a chance or an opportunity to do well. And to an extent, that kind of became what they call maladaptive in terms of over-preparing. So you can definitely...
So you could actually do too much.
Yeah, you can definitely do too much, and that kind of brings up questions of overtraining and burnout and things like that. But for me, I was having problems overthinking. Pre-performance anxiety was very high for me. Well, at least the way I interpreted it, which is another distinction. But I interpreted it as bad the way I felt before games, and I really didn't enjoy that discomfort. So I started trying anything to help me relax and calm down and to slow my brain down. So it would start with mindfulness, then it went to meditation, then it went to sensory deprivation tank, the float tank. And the way I kind of explain that is it's the closest thing you can get to not being under gravity. So the water there's a ton of salt in it, so you float. So the gravity component is gone, right? And we're talking about sensory deprivation, all five of your senses kind of shutting those off so that your brain doesn't have to process them.
So there's no music. You're not listening to a podcast. It's still and quiet while you're in there.
You can, you have the certain tanks. We can get into different types of float tanks too, because there's certainly different types of them. But
I had no idea that was such a thing.
There's ones that are like coffins that are just like four by six, which are kind of like cramped. But the nice ones, they kind of look like a huge egg. And when you get in there, like I was 6'2", and I could spread my arms and lay flat, and I wouldn't touch either of the sides. So like that was really cool. So when we talk about our senses, the sense of gravity is removed because you're buoyant in the water, and just your nose and your mouth are, and your ears are kind of above it. And they give you a little pool noodle too, so that your neck is stabilized. There's no light, even though you can have the option to turn kind of like the color spectrum on in there if you want. I went in complete darkness. The water temperature is the exact same temperature as your body, so that kind of removes the sensation of temperature away from you. So it's basically getting your brain in a position where it doesn't have to interpret sensory information. So no sounds.
Complete calmness. Complete nothing.
It's the closest you can get to just nothing.
Yeah.
And the idea behind that is to go in there, sit in there for a bit, and just listen and just see what kind of comes out, and try to understand a little bit more self-awareness of what your brain's doing, what you're doing. And if you can get, I don't want to say centered, but just access a point of calm and nothingness, as you said, because when you're at that level, you're just bombarded with so many different avenues of stimulus, you can call it. So I just wanted to shut off, you know, in a healthy way. And a lot of people do it in unhealthy ways, which is kind of like a coping mechanism. And we all have our own. And I just wanted to try this one to see if I could, you know, like a Sunday night, to kind of bookmark the week and to start the new week, going there on a Sunday, sitting there for an hour. And when you come out, you feel extraordinarily heavy. But you are.
So, see, I was thinking you were going to tell me that you come out feeling light. My brain was saying, oh, this relaxation, arms out, just no weight, no gravity. I'd walk out of there and I'd feel like I was a feather. So it's the opposite of what I would have thought intuitively.
Yeah, it's not heavy in a negative way, though. You know, it's more of you're not under gravity, and then you finally, because even when you're sleeping, you're under gravity, right? Even though you're laying down, but you come out and then you feel that weight again of the atmosphere. And it's kind of like an awareness perspective of like, oh, wow, I never really actually perceived that weight that I'm carrying of just like walking, of just existing on Earth. That's kind of an existential theme. But I just got out of there and I was really heavy and I was really tired. And after that, I would sleep so well. Like I would sleep really, really well, which was one of the biggest benefits. But when you're someone who is highly pensive, which I would call myself, in terms of judging, analyzing your game and trying to find those avenues, then you're going to need an appropriate counter to no stone unturned. And the sensory tank is like, there are no stones to turn. You're here and this is what you're doing. So it was just trying to find that balance, because I was type A, going down the one path too much. And it was becoming a little too heavy, so to speak.
And now that, you know, post-career, you're studying to be a counselor, you're at Boston University in the sports psychology department, and you're with the goal of being a mental performance coach and working with goalies, working with athletes. I'm sure now when you think about your time in the float tank, you have maybe a different perspective now than you had then. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's incredibly accurate. Part of the reason why I got in this field was kind of selfish. I wanted to know what I did wrong. And I wanted to understand why. I had this feeling that the game would get easier the longer I played it, the more I would get used to it. But the way I felt my first prep school game against Nobles, in terms of just like the nausea, I don't want to get into other symptoms, but just that process remained the same throughout my entire career. And I tried so many different antidotes to getting rid of that emotion.
Yeah.
And in school now, I'm finally learning that trying to suppress that emotion is not possible, and that the art of acceptance of those feelings and reframing those feelings as excitement in your body preparing yourself are way more beneficial to your performance and your health. So I started this program because I wanted to help. I was at Northeastern, and the things I was working with Devin Levi with were, they were technical, but a lot of the stuff was more psychological. It was like, how do we handle success? How do we handle failure? What's our mindset? How do we keep motivation? How do we be kind to ourselves? What's the right amount of work? And I think that's probably the hardest concept in preparation, is what's enough versus what's too much, or and what's not enough. That sweet spot, that Goldilocks zone of preparation, where you got your work in, but you still have energy to play the game. I burned all of my energy reserves before the game was even played. Like, an NHL day is so long. You wake up at 7, you get your meal. It can't be late for your meal. You got to do your routine and your process. I got to get my stretch in, or else my hips are going to be killing me. I got to get off the ice at a certain time so I can get my lunch, so I can get home, so I can take my nap. And if I don't watch a movie before my nap, I won't be able to fall asleep. If I don't fall asleep, I won't play well. That's just an example of like the catastrophizing and the bad routines that I was having. Like, it was so strict, and it's almost superstition. And that kind of became so negative that, I wasn't having any fun anymore, because I was tired all the time. I was thinking all the time, trying to suppress stuff, when I really should have been learning to sit with those emotions, not judge them, and just feel them. And that's, I've been in school for a year now, and that's probably the biggest revelation that I've had.
So the word that was popping in my mind was embracing that feeling, because that was, it's so ironic as a goalie dad, from being a former goalie. So when the pregame anxiety stopped, when my career ended, when I was done playing in Europe, it was such a relief not to deal with game days. And I was fine once I got my first shot. Like, after the first shot, you're fine. Like, it's no big deal. It's just all that time leading up to it. And now I have to experience it all over again through my son. When he has a game that day, I know he's got a game that day, and I'm hoping it's going well. Merce, how are you with pregame anxiety?
It depended on the year. My last year of hockey, it was really bad. I was kind of like Condo here, and like everything had to be perfect and everything had to be on time. And then just the fact of the matter was, it was exhausting mentally. So once the puck drops, you're so exhausted mentally that it's almost hard to focus, and you're anxious because you're mentally drained, right? So it's hard to keep that, like Condo was talking about, like motivation, like keep those mental gears firing, because I'm so exhausted by the time the game rolls around. So, I mean, can we just dive into like the exhaustion piece of it, right? Like, what kind of went into it for you, Condo?
It's so funny we talk about this. I went to a talk yesterday about heart rate variability, mm-hmm. and how it's a biomarker of resilience and self-regulation. So I'm at the beginning of understanding it. So I'm not an expert, I'm not a doctor, but they do all these tests with people where there's a famous one about a tracing test that people do, and they have two groups, a control group and a study group. And the control group was asked to do something stressful, I believe, and to think about it and to try and suppress those emotions and then do the tracing exam. And the other group was told to just feel the emotions and do the tracing exam. And the people who were trying to control and suppress, they quit the exam more often than not, whereas the other people who were accepting their emotions, they finished it. So you're depleting a resource is what the argument is when you're suppressing things. Like, you're actively fighting yourself. And the resource there is actually blood sugar. It's glucose. So you're diminishing energy fighting yourself, fighting a feeling when you're about to perform. And that's kind of been like a big revelation for me just in the past 24 hours. And it's hard because there's so many cliches about performance. Like, I always used to hear like pressure is a privilege, or get comfortable being uncomfortable, and all those things. And that just really like invalidated how I felt at the moment. Like, I didn't need advice. I just needed someone to listen. So when we're thinking about all those things and overthinking and the pressure and the anxiety of it all, it was just learning to accept is really a skill, and it's a muscle, and it's not something that we're taught ever throughout school to our adulthood. So that's probably one of the biggest things that I'm wrestling with right now and trying to get better at explaining to other people.
I think we've all experienced most goalies would have experienced this pregame anxiety, and you had a different word for it. I used pregame anxiety. What did you call it earlier?
Pre-performance anxiety.
Okay, pre-performance anxiety. And so when I think about these things that you did, the meditation, the hyperbaric chamber, and all these different modalities that you did. So what I'm getting the sense of is, Dak, it's not about the modalities. It's more about why I was looking for those modalities.
Yeah.
And then it was more about the mindset that they affected me more from a mindset standpoint than it wasn't about the body or feeling better. It was more whatever you were doing, you were trying to get your head in a better place.
Yeah, I thought the more I was prepared, the more I studied for the test, the better I would feel going into the exam. And preparation is still a huge key of it, but kind of as you said, my preparation and relaxation became stressful. So it was a self-defeating kind of feedback loop that I was doing. I didn't learn how to relax properly. I didn't know how to breathe. And there's a lot of misnomers about breathing right now too that actually make you perform worse. And not a lot of people.
You have to know which breathing technique at which stage.
Yeah.
To
like,
you.
Yeah. Like basically like just the idea of carbon dioxide in your body. People think that increases your anxiety and all that. And that's not further from the truth. You need carbon dioxide in your body so that you can actually absorb oxygen. So I didn't know all those things. So I was doing like different types of breathing techniques before games that were actually hurting me, and I didn't know it. And I guess through all this, the message is knowledge is power. Mm-hmm. And to really vet your sources too, because there's so much in the age of TikTok, Instagram, all these things. There's so many experts out there, and I'm not purporting to be one. I'm just saying that you really have to do your due diligence in figuring out what's true. And that's really just going to the primary sources and reading the studies. Like, you go on Google Scholar, you just type in breath, and the middle of the studies are complex with the data, but they have an abstract which just says like, this is the study, this is what we learned, and it's like a paragraph. And okay, got
the,
it.
The overview is like, yes. What I do the same thing. You have these studies and you go, no way I'm reading this, and then no you way. Read the last paragraph and,
yeah.
and it sums up everything for you.
Yeah, I failed statistics in college and undergrad, so I'm not going to be reading all the statistical information, but I read the abstract, I read the conclusion, I try to read in the middle. But you go to the primary source, and then so that's evidence, right? And there's a time for evidence, and then there's a time for, you know, philosophy. You know, how do you go about understanding your meaning and why you're playing the game, which is a whole nother part. Because before
which is huge. We did that in the Stop and Go to NEU primer. I think it was a couple weeks ago. It was about why, like, and one of the things recently we did, you know. What do you love? What do you love about goaltending? The next day was, what do you love about hockey? What do you love about being a student? What do you love about being a teammate? And we ended off with, what do you love about yourself? You know, I think that goes into that why, right?
Yeah, I mean that's the driver for everything. I think it was Nietzsche who said, "He who has a why can live through almost any how." Mm. So I had a very strong why, which propelled me to meet all those pressure demands, and I knew it really well. And whys can be broken up extrinsically and intrinsically. So extrinsic things are, I call them carrots. Like you put a carrot in front of yourself, you want the carrot, right? Like I want the D1 scholarship. I want to go play pro. I want those things. I want, you know, money, fame, notoriety. Those are all good, right? To an extent. But once you get that carrot, if you don't have anything inside of you, you're kind of left with no direction or drive because you got what you wanted. So it's having that healthy balance, and the intrinsic part is much harder to figure out for people. But that's the more philosophical side, which I really love getting into. Psychology is only, you know, 1860 with Freud was when it really came about. And before that, what people used was theology or faith, and then yep. philosophy. How do we understand our place in this world? What is the world? Why am I doing what I'm doing? And you kind of need all three. You need a philosophical approach. You need a faith-based approach too, because when you're in there and it's not going well, sometimes you pray. and then you need
the psychology. Bert spent most of his career praying. He's
no kidding. Hey, so I talked to someone today about emotions, right? So we were talking about emotions and performance, and we always talk about being stoic as a goaltender. We're always teaching, like, be that stoic being, like that head up, shoulders up, like that whole thing. But there's that piece of emotion. We're all human, right? We're not just robot goaltenders, right? So I kind of want to dive into the emotional piece too, because like, say I feel angry during the day, right? Like, how do we move that? If it's a game day, how do we move that into that stoic piece, right? Because we can't just like you talked about, we can't just suppress these emotions, like that study that you were talking about, the heart rate variability. But like, there's so many emotions that go throughout a day. How do we get to that place where we can just get into that flow state and perform?
Ooh, that's a big one. I always like to start with why, and why these things happen. And the bigger question is like, what's the purpose of emotions? Why do we have them? Right? Where do they come from? What do they do? And that's more of like a evolutionary biology thing. And so you said anger, right? The biggest question you have to ask yourself is, do you perform better when you're angry?
100%. With Mercy, you were talking about that. I was thinking about, we did a talk the other day, and it was about being assertive, mm-hmm. being angry, being aggressive, being called, like, but it didn't suit for everybody. And we right. actually went around a room of 18 goalies talking about, what do you need to be? Mm-hmm. What? And I think that's what experience gets you, right? Kind of like all those games in the minors got you an idea, like, what you had to do to be able to perform.
Yeah. And a great example of that was, you know, my first year in Montreal, I would look at Carey Price before games, and he would just be calm and kind of chill. And I knew there was a drive inside, but he didn't let you see it. And so I would see him play, and everything was smooth. Everything was calculated, but still powerful. And I was like, oh, I want to be like that. And so I tried an approach before a game of just like not really doing a warm up and kind of just chilling out and just sitting in the locker room. And I found with me that during the game, I wasn't fighting around screens. I was passive. I was on my heels, and I didn't play well. We lost. And I learned there, I was like, you're not Carey Price, and don't try to be Carey Price. In the psychological perspective of that is something called the individual zone of optimal performance. And we all have different ranges of emotions that help us play better. And you would think of something like feeling anxious is a bad thing, but you need a certain amount of anxiety to play. That's something that drives your function. That fight or flight is still good in game. Anger is another one. I always show a clip of Tom Brady of how he would kind of create that anger against the other team. In The Last Dance with Michael Jordan, he would make up stories about people in the building saying things to him that didn't actually happen just so that he could get a chip. But they had high emotional intelligence. They knew what they needed in order to be at their best. And when you're a goalie and you're thinking about being assertive, like, guys are coming down the ice at 30 miles an hour at you. You have to stand your ground. You can't back up. You have to stick your face into slap shots. You can't turn away. There is a certain degree of anger if that's your fuel. Or what's the bigger question is, what's going to make you stick your face in that puck?
Mm-hmm.
Some people want to be calm. Other people need to be angry. Some need to have a little bit of fear. And I used fear a lot. I have this huge fear of regret is what really propelled me to do all the things. Cause I came to this point where I was just like, some people are better than me. They have more talent. I get that, but it's not going to be because I didn't work hard. Mm-hmm. And once I came to that thing, that emotional state, I was like, all right, effort. You're an effort guy. You're not pretty. You can't do the splits. Some days you can't touch your toes, but we got to find a way. And that was kind of, that is kind of a form of acceptance, is some people are more talented than me, but I'm not going to lose because I didn't try. And I think that's a great state too. The other one is, I can do everything right and lose, and I can do everything wrong and win. So that's really great for people who are holding on to outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so when we have that outcome-based mentality, you could have 38 saves going into overtime, but you're losing the shootout, still lost.
And when you're playing pro, that's all that matters. It's all they care about, whether you win or lose. You can give up 5 goals and win 6-5. Oh, Kondo made that big save to get us that 2 points. And if you lose 2-1, didn't come up with that big save in the third period on the breakaway and didn't get that's the product of it. The process versus product.
And the scary thing is that you have to, you're obviously aware of that's how you're judged. You're judged off your outcomes. And that's the hardest thing for goalies, is you know that's the metric that people judge you off of, but how do you not pay attention to that? And that's why the investment into mental skills and strength is kind of like the fourth pillar of performance. And the way I've read that, the best way to explain it is, like, you got your physical, which is your strength, your conditioning, your pliability, your mobility. You have the strategic, which is what the other team is going to do on their power play. What are people's tendencies? You need to know that and how you're going to meet them. Then there's the technical, you know, when are you using RVH? When are you sliding? When are you staying on your feet? And the fourth component is, how are you taking care of yourself? What emotional states do you need to get in? What do you need right now? How aware are you of your processes? Mm-hmm. And if you invest equally into those four parts, you will feel prepared. And that's probably one of the best feelings.
So it's funny you're talking, and I was thinking about, like, after hockey, and I was thinking about vacation. I was speaking with a very, very good goalie the other day, 16 years old, ultra talented, probably heading to be a D1 kid who never takes time off. And I was on a call with him and his dad, and I was preaching on my 8 weeks. So I'm always, and we're going to get into the physical part later, but the health, goaltending, actual physical health later, but I was expressing my opinion of, you need to take 8 weeks. You need to get away, just totally get away from it. And I was explaining to the father, it's just like you know, you own your own business. You go to Hawaii for 2 weeks, you come back, you're full of ideas, because all of a sudden everything just starts flowing for you because you stop working and you have all these great ideas and insights. And when I think back of myself as a goaltender, I never really thought enough. So, you know, it's so funny when I think back now, like my coaches must have just, oh, I must have driven them crazy, because if we were playing on a Saturday night and we had the nationally televised in Switzerland, so we get the nationally televised game and we're playing the first place team, second place, whatever it is, like I'm going to show up. But when we're on the road on a Tuesday night to a lower level team and the barn is half empty and it's raining outside, like, don't put me in that. But at that time, I couldn't figure out that those were the times where I needed to figure out a way to get those juices going. And I think now, if I look back, if I would have taken some time to think, why do I play good some nights? Why do I not? I probably would have put the puzzle together while I was playing as opposed to after.
Yeah. I think the concept you're getting at is you can't see the forest through the trees, right? And that's another debate of perception versus perspective. And perception is how you see the world. Perspective is how you see yourself from the world in. Right. And you need to be able to do both, because your perceptions aren't invalid. They're true, because that's how you see things. Mm-hmm. However, if you stay in that one frame of mind the whole time, kind of like you're talking about, Dak, you got blind spots. We all have blind spots. The ability to step outside of yourself and to look at yourself, like the Stoics said, from like a bird's eye view, look down upon yourself into the world. You take your blinders from this to this and you slowly open up. You're not going to go complete 180 degree field of view right off the bat, but if you can go and just open them up a little bit, you'll be able to see more things about yourself, more things that you may need to improve. You may be able to recognize that you're grinding so hard and that you need to actually relax a little bit. You may even see that you may need to work harder. But you only do that when you become aware. And that's kind of one of the pillars of improvement or behavior change, is that you have to be aware before you can enhance. Otherwise, you're just investing down a wrong path. And that's probably one of the worst things to do, is to reinforce bad habits, reinforce things that aren't working, which I certainly did a ton of, especially when I think of my hip and back health at 33 years old. So that's the biggest thing, perception versus perspective. You need both, but you need to be able to switch in and out constantly in order to see where you are in the world, see what you need to do, and also give yourself credit. You know, yeah. Like some nights in the NHL, I was miserable and I was just like, I had no perspective. I tried, but it's hard to do, but it's just like, and you were talking earlier about like, what do you enjoy about the game and things like that. The hardest part about the game, especially when you're playing an 82-game season, is that it's monotonous. Your enemy is complacency, and you're always fighting against complacency. Like, I would get a fresh pair of goalie pads out of the box, and I would just look at them like, oh, another set. If I was 12, I'd be losing my mind. I got another pair of goalie pads. Yeah. I can order whatever pads I want. I can get demos from every single company in my colors and how I want them. How cool
is that? With your name on them?
With my name on them. Like, I'm flying on a chartered jet eating steak. Like, I was on I was in the East Coast on a 16-hour bus ride 2 years ago. Like, where was my perspective? It really wasn't there. But the only way you really get that is if you're able to sit still, slow down, stop the processing, and listen. And try to see yourself, which is
mindfulness, right? Like,
so you're talking, and I remember starting with the Toronto Maple Leafs. Okay. And so my job, goaltending scout, and I'm trying to soak up as much knowledge as I can from the veteran scouts, the guys at the Garth Malarchuks, the legends, and I'm poking their brain. And it's incredible what they come back with when they say, oh, yeah, see, Dak, you got to understand where they're at with self-awareness. And I'm sitting there going, no, it's how quick they are. or is how big they are, or, you know, do they give up two goals quickly? Or, like, I'm thinking all these things, and they're talking about self-awareness. And their point is that you've got to draft a kid at 18 years old, and that kid's got to figure it out. And I can see it. The players, goalie, defenseman, forward, the players you miss on and you don't understand, like, that player checked every box. But if they don't have self-awareness, they're not going to get better. They're not going to be able, the figure out ability part is out the window. They won't be able to do it.
I think what you're getting at, I think of two quotes from Greek scholars. I confuse them all, so please don't carve me on this. But one of them is know thyself. And the other one is the unexamined life is not worth living. I'm not sure if it was Plato, Seneca, or any one of those guys, but all these cultures knew that. Marcus Aurelius, a Stoic too, he knew that. It's so crazy how so much wisdom is out there from recorded history, and we don't access it. And these are people who are living lives that were 10 times more difficult than us, where death and war and suffering was everywhere. Yes. And they're writing about how they got through it. And we don't really check in with that. They give you these insights. They're not specific, but they spark curiosity. So, like, what is the unexamined life is not worth living mean? It's just like, you got to look at yourself in the mirror, see what you're doing, see where you're deficient, see where you're strong, see where you want to go. Are you living your vision? Are you living your passion? Are you in the right environment? What about your environment don't you understand? There's so many questions that come from this, but it's also, everything exists kind of on a continuum. You know, if you get too introspective, too much looking into yourself, you're going to have more questions than answers. But if you don't get introspective at all, you're going to have a lot of answers with no questions. And that's kind of arrogance.
So are you saying life is about balance?
Listen, everything
which my parents taught me when I was a young kid.
Yeah, it's funny, like, everything in your body is already balancing itself. Every cell, every, your heart rate, you have this thing called homeostasis, where you stay at the same temperature. Your cells don't take more nutrients than they need. All those things, there's balance everywhere, except not so much in our thoughts. I think we all could benefit from an analysis of how balanced we are in our thoughts. So moderation is the key. I forget that what that quote is, but moderation in everything, even moderation. So there's something to be said to that. Yeah.
It's so funny that you talk about, you know, you're going into stoicism and the pragmatics and so on, but you know, so I am a big personal growth junkie, and you have those people like you're Tony Robbins and you're Mel Robbins and you're Les Browns and all these people. Now it's Goggins, right? Jocko Willing. So, but if you go back just a little bit, you want to go back 50 years, 60 years to Earl Nightingale. He was selling the same, like, it was the same thing. And then you want to go back 50 years before that and the power of concentration. The power of concentration could be written, like, it could be written today. Obviously, they'd have to change the way English is used, but the power of concentration, it's the same thing that you're going to get from all the personal growth guys. There's no different. There's nothing different in the last 100 years of the way that people thought. And you're going back even farther than that. So now we got a young Mercer with us, right? We got a young Adam Mercer.
Getting older every day.
And we've talked a lot about philosophy. And let's get into actually things that we can do, okay? Whether it's journal. Right. You know, if you're talking to Adam, a young Adam Mercer is 14 years old. And what can we, based on this conversation, what can we leave that goalie? What can you do on your own because we put a lot of thoughts in parents' minds today and coaches' minds and goals' minds. How can we take these kind of thoughts and put them into practice?
I think the first thing you have to do before, I mean, in sports psychology, they call those interventions, like specific tasks or habits that you can use, but you have to know why you're doing them in the first place. So there's such a rush to be like, oh, I should start journaling. Well, you need to know why you want to start journaling. That's the biggest part. And it always comes back to why, because that's the motivating action behind the habit. Why do you want to journal? Well, if journaling helps because your hand works slower than your brain. So it forces you to actually slow down, use those neural networks to articulate abstract concepts onto paper. And then you can see them. And people, when I ask them when they journal and they do things like that, they see their thoughts more comprehensively. So instead of your brain being like a dryer machine on tumble, all these things bouncing around, you put them down, you can see them, you just gained a little bit of perspective. Now a little bit more direction. And then from that, you look at your journals over time, you can see your own growth. You can see patterns about yourself that maybe you want to change or not change. And that's really one of the benefits of journaling. But to your point, when you're choosing a specific thing, you need to know why you're doing that and if that's matching what they call your presenting concern. What's the biggest thing you want to change or want to improve upon? That's the biggest thing. So I guess with journaling, the presenting concern for that, maybe you're overthinking. Maybe you want to get a little bit more aware of your thought processes. And anything with using your hand, like drawing, is a huge form of therapy in terms of expressing artistically what is in your head. And it's funny when people draw, like, hey, draw how you felt in the last game. Like, was there a symbol where, like, can you picture a personified object? Maybe you were a mountain, maybe you were a wall, maybe you were a tiger. And then they start drawing, and then you make sure you give them a bunch of different colors and a bunch of different utensils, and then you can ask them, it's like, why'd you use yellow? Why'd you use black? What does this mean? Why are you so small in relation to other things? And then that starts this cool conversation of you're taking the contents of your brain and you're putting it in an image, and there's a lot that can be gleaned from that. So I think that's a good breakdown of the writing aspect too. There's also, you know, letter writing. I think it's called emotional disclosure in writing form, where you write letters never intended to be mailed, but about people who you're angry at or things like that, or not even anger, any type of emotion. You write it down as if they're going to read it. And that's just, it's cathartic. It's almost like emotional dumping the contents out of your head onto something else so that something else can hold it now. You don't have to.
If someone's communicative, right? So like as a coach, you have to understand, you know, is your goalie someone that needs to talk?
Yeah.
And I even back with the Bruins, I had a little code there with Byron Defoe, and I'd walk through the locker room after every period and I'd tap him on the pads as I went by. If he said something, I stopped and we would talk. If he didn't, I just kept on going, because he was just someone. We talked before the game, after the game, during the game. He felt better if he could get it out as opposed to keeping it. So that's just a little bit of understanding. And speaking of the coaching end, because I'm dying to find out, like, obviously, for us, we've all seen the success of Devon Levi. When you retired as a goaltender, you started coaching at Northeastern University. I believe it was two seasons, correct?
Yep.
Two seasons, and you had Devon Levi, who is arguably the greatest college goaltender ever statistically.
Him and Ryan Miller.
I don't think anybody put up those numbers, right?
It was all me.
Even better than a Mikey Condon at Princeton. So you can argue that. So I'm gonna ask you about this year working with the junior team from the mental part. But before that, I want to dive in a little bit about your experience transitioning from a goalie to a coach, having tremendous success as a coach working with Devin. And I was wondering if you could give us, as I'm a coach, we've got goalies listening, we got parents listening, some nuggets that you took away that you figured out in your 2 years of coaching an elite goaltender.
Yeah, the first one that comes to mind is the labeling of deficiencies. When I played, certain coaches would be like, we need to work on your blocker. You're getting exposed on your blocker. You're deficient on your blocker. And then all of a sudden you internalize that. And then if you say it enough, you will start to believe it. And so when I would see a perceived deficiency in Dev, I wouldn't go up to him and be like, hey, we're going to crush blocker today because you got beat blocker side. No, I would put him in a situation and say, this is the drill. You're going to step off your post and you're just going to receive a shot. But the shots would probably be 80% blocker, 20% glove. And then I would go to him, I talk to him, hey, how'd that feel? What'd you think? And then he would be, oh, okay, I felt this and I felt that. Okay, let's do it one more time. It's about not, when you're a goalie coach, you take things off the plate, you don't put things on. And I think that was the biggest role. And that can be technical concerns, that could be emotional things, confidence things. And it is it was type of a therapeutic relationship where just being able to sit in a room with somebody and talk, right? People have this conception that when you go to in a counseling or therapeutic situation, that it's always about, you know, using interventions or modalities like cognitive behavioral therapy or acceptance commitment therapy. They want all these tangible things, but it's really just sitting there and talking to someone who you trust and have what they call rapport, like that you get along with somebody. But the predicators of that relationship is confidentiality, that what I'm going to say to you is going to stay with you. Mm-hmm. So that way that trust is built up. Then I can actually tell you how I feel. And as we were talking about with the drawing and the writing, you're bringing stuff out and you're bringing it out into the light. If you suppress and you bury, I usually make the analogy of it's like mold. You know, if you put water and bread and you put it in your cupboard for 2 months in the dark, you're going to have something crazy when you open that up, and it grows, and mold grows on decaying matter. So I'm not saying that a part of you inside is decaying, but kind of is, because you're suppressing it and it's staying with you. You need to let it out. You need to get it out. The problem is finding that confidential relationship is the hardest thing. And I got burned a few times trusting people who I thought had my best interest in mind, and come to find out that was my whole exit meeting. So I would caution goalies, I'd caution anybody. If you're going to reveal those things and get into that relationship, you got to have trust, and it has to be confidential. And not many teams have that at the college level. And I would even argue at the professional level, you have to be careful with that too. I had the opportunity in the professional ranks to work with a team psychologist, and I told the captain that, and the captain looked at me and was like, what are you doing? Do not work with that person. And I'm not sure if I wholeheartedly believe that now, but in the moment I stopped, because you're like a stock at the pro level. You're like an Amazon or an Apple.
Yep.
And everything about you is judged just like a quarterly earnings sheet. All your baggage, your character, your emotions, all that is information that's going to be used in you. I mean, look at the NFL draft right now with all these guys, and they're nitpicking every single athlete about their behavior and their mannerisms and everything. You're under a microscope. You have to be careful of who you reveal yourself to. And that's probably one of the biggest parts of it. And Dak, I know you're probably going to ask about my work with the team I'm with now, but in that light of confidentiality, I can't really speak about that. So as much as I appreciate the question, I can't really go there. But in speaking with Dev, I wasn't in a therapeutic relationship with him, even though I said that, like, hey, everything you say to me stays with me. And I'm not revealing what he's saying now. I'm just revealing what I told him in terms of practice design. Yeah. And I had agreement with the coaches too. I went to Coach Keefe and everyone there. I says, you can't ask me anything about what they're saying because I won't tell you. And I explained that to them too. It's like, this rule is in place because it's going to benefit the team in the long run. So I'm working for you in a circuitous manner, and just please trust that. And it worked out. But with Dev, like I said, it wasn't always the technical T pushing RVH one. Yeah, there's a point in time for that. But when you get into these upper echelons of performance, the skill level differentiation is like 1%, 2%. The difference between guys is consistency, which is, albeit an aspect of mental performance. So the mental game, like for Sidney Crosby to get 1% better, how hard does he have to work? How do you refine what's been refined so many times? When you're an expert, that 1%'s a light year. It's so big, but there's always gains to be made in between the years. And that's the difference at the highest levels of performance.
So Merce, like that nugget right there a little bit earlier, because that I was like, can I write this down all in the middle of a podcast? But I feel the same way. You do not have to go to your goaltender as a coach and tell them what you're working on. You can do it without getting in their head and them thinking, oh, well, we're doing this because Dak doesn't think I'm good at this. Right. And so that, and Merce, you're in the junior ranks right now, and you're getting into the team coaching for the first time now that you're done as a goaltender. I mean, I feel the same way as Kondo on that. I feel like especially when you start a season, he's not good at this, he's not good at that, she's not good at this, she's not good at that, like they're done.
100%.
You got to nip away at it.
Well, like just at like the college and the junior level, like especially the junior level, these kids are trying to move on to the next level, right? Especially at the college level, they're trying to move on to the pro level, right? So staying out of their heads as a goalie coach couldn't be more valuable. And I like the confidentiality piece that Kondo was talking about with the coaching staff, just because it gives the goalie this place where they can go to be comfortable and be honest and get those thoughts out, just like journaling or drawing, just like Kondo was saying. But that's invaluable for all goalies if they can find that person, whether it be a goalie coach, whether it be a parent, even just finding that place where you can stay comfortable and get your thoughts out and your emotions out.
Parents are tough though.
100%.
The parent aspect is difficult because parents love their kids, and the therapeutic aspect is that it's unbiased.
Right. Yeah.
I'm seeing it because, and the other part too is parents are often solutions based. So you two could probably speak to this well, but you know, if I love my dad to death, but when I give him a problem that I have, he waits 2 hours and then I get a text message of 4 solutions and 5 people I can call. I wasn't looking for that though. Sometimes it's just a vent.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, and you know, even with my wife too, like as men, like we're often like solutions based people, and you love someone so much that you want to provide relief to their suffering. And you think that is through a solution, a tangible thing. Hey, do this. You know, it's like people oftentimes you'll see on social media someone who's really depressed and people will just be like, go for a run. And it's just like, no.
It helps.
Yeah, movement's part of it, but what you're doing is you're actually invalidating how that person feels at the moment. We need to recognize how they feel in order for them to accept it and for them to realize it and for them to be ready, and if they're ready, to actually make some change. So it's always, I always make this analogy. It's nice to have that guy in the scene from The Town where Ben Affleck walks into Jeremy Renner's room and he's like, hey, we're going to go hurt some people. You can't ask any questions. And that's that. And Jeremy Renner looks up and just goes, whose car are we taking? I'm not advocating violence, but that's the example of the friend or the outlet of the person who you trust and is non-judgmental and just is there to listen. Listening is such a skill that not many people know how to do. before I entered this program, and still to this point, like, I have my answer ready to go before the other person's done talking. I've probably done it on this podcast already. Listening is hard. Hearing someone is hard, not just what they're saying, but what they're not saying, what they're trying to say. There's so much nuance in there. So being an active listener, there's books on it. You may think it's a pretty simple thing, like, hey, don't talk and open your ears. Well, no, it's a lot deeper than that. Like this conversation that we're having now, it's just like eye contact, hand position, body language. They call these minimal encouragers when you're like, yeah, no, I see that. The simple furrowing of a brow is interpreted by humans in many different ways, and most of our communication is nonverbal. So the act of learning how to help is what I'm in school for, and it's completely complex. So, Merce, I didn't mean to say that don't talk to your parents.
No. I get
talk to your parents, but just be aware that, you know, they want to help. So they're going to give you tangible things, and maybe your parents are emotionally intelligent where they're at the point where they can just listen to you and say, yeah, you know what, that stinks, man. Like, I'm sorry you're going through that. How can I help? That's right. All people sometimes are really looking for is the validation of their feelings, the normalization of their feelings, that, hey, what you're going through, a lot of people go through, and the praise too. You got to praise people, not absolutely overpraise them. You don't want to blow smoke, but it's just like, hey, you know,
praise.
Yeah. Like, what you're going through is really hard. Like, how strong have you had to be to go through this? Like, hey, you're still here. Normalize, validate, praise. If there's three things that you can take away from this talk when someone's coming to you with a problem, or in your relationship, those are three things that I don't see can lead you down a wrong path. So that's a big aspect of it.
Now for me, I love the In Gold podcast, and I always get a chuckle when Woody goes, well, we've kept you a long time, which we have today, but I've got one more question.
Do it.
and because I just want to go through it and the health of a goaltender and what we put ourselves through physically. And you had your battles later on in your career in the hip, and
still do.
Yeah, and I'll never forget, you were playing, you had made the Montreal Canadiens, and you had a game against Boston, and I came down to talk to you after the morning skate, and the next game you had was Ottawa, and that was going to be your first game, I think. And you told me you had a high ankle sprain, but you couldn't tell anybody because you were so horrified that if you told someone, you'd be rehab, sent down to the minors, and may never get another chance. And you said, I'm going to figure out a way to work through this pain and stay. So I say that, I tell that story because it puts in perspective who you are, and the sacrifices that we make for our health. And I try to talk to goalies and goalie parents as much as I can about hip health and taking care of their bodies. And I just didn't want to let you go without having you, from personal experience, address this a little bit to our listeners and talk a little bit about kind of your experiences. And now that you're on the other side of it, you know, what you could offer to our parents, our goalies, and our goalie coaches.
Yeah, that was probably one. I still wrestle with this. Telling myself you should have told somebody so that you could have figured it out. But at the same time, I knew what the environment was I was operating in. And it was, availability is the best ability. And I can't give them a reason, and I have to play through this if I want to stick around. And I taped that ankle up from pretty much my toes to the bottom of my knee, pretty much just to mobilize the leg, and I got by kinda.
No, you did great.
I stuck around, but you know, today I still wrestle with the ankle injury, and it actually pushed my hip out of its socket with a herniated disc, and I need a hip replacement. So the question I think about now is, do the ends justify the means? I think so, because I achieved my goal, which we talked earlier about extrinsic motivation, and financial concerns were a big component for me in my identity when I kind of grew up a little financially insecure. I mean, Dak, you know, there were a few stop at goaltending balances that went a little bit too long.
Hey, you're still in the books, Connor. I still got to do some collection here from accounts receivable.
Oh, what's the interest on that? But, you know, but I mean, that was the awareness of that's the awareness that I didn't have about myself in terms of, you know, financial insecurity and how that became a strong motivator, but to an extent, a detriment. I was willing to jeopardize things for achieving, you know, getting a contract. But that was my process, and I'm okay with it. And to say that you playing for money is wrong is not, I think that's asinine. You know, financial incentives for what you're doing at that level, the amount of pressure, the risk of being a goaltender. I mean, you can die playing hockey. And we saw it the other day, unfortunately, in England. You have irreparable health consequences, especially when you talk about your brain. I was even concussed a couple of times. I didn't say anything. Sitting in a hotel room before a game, just being like, whoa, like this is not okay, but I got to go out there. Mm-hmm. But I look at that now, and it's just the, how would I phrase it? It was kind of the grace that you can give yourself when you know you're hurt. And some people can do that and others can't. I couldn't do that. I couldn't not play. Watching was so painful. I had to be in there. I couldn't let anyone down. And that really paralleled all throughout, you know, just even letting in a bad goal or anything like that. I was so interested.
Do you agree that today's environment is more forgiving of that?
Injury or mistakes?
Injuries. And being able to say, look, I'm hurt. I need help. Back, we're going back, you know, 10 years or so, and then you want to go back 20, 30 years. And I think it's progressively gotten better to the point where it is now.
Yeah, I think people are starting to advocate for themselves as this kind of old guard of athletic coaching is leaving. Like, you know, you hear the phrases like water equals weakness. That was one that was around for a bit. Are you hurt or are you injured? Those are two different things, especially to old time coaches. But, you know, you got that pressure from everyone. And also the, you know, if I took time off, that opens the door from somebody else. I made my way into pro hockey because three goalies got hurt in front of me in succession. And that's the only way I got my chance. So, there's a fine line between hurt and injured, what you can play through and what you can't. When you think about the brain, like I made a ton of mistakes with that. Goaltenders with subconcussive blows, which are arguably more detrimental than the major concussions because they compile. And sometimes I like right now, am I struggling with my words because I'm tired or I haven't eaten lunch, or is there something else going on? There's always that insecurity of, two players in the last week committed suicide with CTE. Well, Chris Simon was, a lot of CTE concerns there. I'm not sure what the issues were with the Russian player, but there's a cost to play in this game. I don't mean to take it on a morbid sense, but I mean, these are things that we have to be aware of. We have to learn from these people
we also have to take a little bit of that in our own hands too. We talked about this before. I mean, do you really have to do 200 butterflies a day? In your goaltending coach's justification skates, do you really have to go in your RVH 37 times in a row? Like I think we've got to do a little better job from us with experience now to advocate so that, you know, geez, you know how to butterfly. You don't have to do it 1,000 times, right? You'd have to do it. You have to do it at spots and so on and so forth. But I think where we're at right now, I think we can help this next generation to understand, like, the physical challenges you have now, be because you sucked it up and you were a warrior and so on and so forth. I think you get to that balance. Yeah. Right. You get back, you know, you are probably too far on the warrior side and not taking care of yourself and advocating for yourself enough when you had to play through stuff. I think, you know, once again, there's that fine line and that balance.
Yeah. You mentioned guys like Jocko and David Goggins earlier and this obsession with grind mentality. And that's something that I loved. I loved it. I say things like, you know, the only easy day was yesterday. You know, your feelings don't matter, you know, suck it up and get out there. And that was just attacking myself. And I look at like a guy like Goggins and he's like, his knees are shot, you know, like what's he going to do in 10 years? And talking about the body, like, and especially when working with Dev, it was like, hey, you're 18, you're young and fresh, you're able to heal. That's not going to last for forever. You need to learn that fine line of what's enough and what's too much. And in practice, it would just be like, we're going to do 5 RVHs on each side just to warm up because you're probably going to do 200 in the practice. And then I would go to Coach Keefe. The first shooting drill, Dev's not going down. He's just going to work on his hands. But I would tell Dev that there's a motive behind it. Hey, let's play goalie. Let's stop pucks with our hands. Go down and get it. You know, don't default to the butterfly. But I would also tell the coach, like, hey, don't judge him
right
because he's not going down because it's with a purpose. And then Deb would stay out for a couple 30 minutes after practice. And it was just about telling him like, hey, how many butterflies do you think you did in that extra practice and playing rebound game? Like, I don't know, like 30 or 40 or 50. I'm like, multiply that by 6 months, 7 months. You know, you have a finite amount of butterflies. The amount of number that is, I don't know, but it is a finite amount. So pitchers are on pitch counts. Goalies repetitive motion have to be on butterfly counts. Mm-hmm. But I think for young players, it's important to understand how the body works. Do you know that your jaw directly impacts your pelvic alignment? Do you know that hip pain is directly correlated to the amount of space you have in your lumbar spine? Mm-hmm. Do you know what the psoas is? And that's the only muscle that attaches your femur to your lumbar, your upper half from your lower half of your body. It's one muscle. It's your psoas. Do you know that? Do you know how to strengthen it? What do you know about posterior chain strength? We spend all our time like this.
Yeah.
So in the summer, you don't want to be doing exercises like this. You want to be doing exercises that expand, open up, and go backwards.
Expand that chest. Expand the chest. Yeah.
People talk about head trajectory, and it's like, well, what's the science about that? Well, I mean, I always played with my head like this, trying to get on it, but all of our muscles, our eye muscles are back here. So when you do that, you pinch them off and you can't see as well. The idea is you tuck your chin a little bit more right here, get your spine in neutral position. All of a sudden you can see more. You can see your hands, which is important for actually directing where they go. Your shoulder strength and your hip strength are directly correlated. Your body is a big X. Your right shoulder and your left glute, they work with each other. And there's certain ways you can kind of learn that. So when you're doing those trivial exercises like Supermans or dead bugs or whatever you call them on the ground, like once you understand why you're doing them, and we go back to why again, then you're going to be more motivated to do them correctly. And let's get away from throwing huge weight on our spine. Mm. Squats, like normal squats or hand cleans, I don't see the point of it. I look at these goalies like Ryan Miller, Sergei Bobrovsky, Andrei Vasilevsky. They're not jacked monsters. They're not going to be on GQ with their shirts off with six packs. They're limber, they're pliable, they're mobile, and they have longevity. The opposite example of that is a guy like Rick DiPietro, who is shredded out of his mind and was jacked, but he's got tendon issues. He got hurt all the time. You have to realize you have to train for your environment, and our environment is one of reaction, which implies fluidity, smoothness, not being muscle bound. And now I'm on the lines in terms of teaching goalies how to move. It's about, you know, go on Instagram and watch a guy named Ido Portal. He was Conor McGregor's movement coach, and he's just doing these weird. Actually, Conor McGregor comes out with those noodle arms, right? But if I asked you to do noodle arms, it would probably not look the way Conor did it. Like there's a body intelligence that you need, and when you're doing a bench press and you're fighting that weight up, all you're doing is you're training your body to be slow. How can you mimic your environment? How can you lessen the load on things that are major muscle movers like your hips and your glutes? Your feet are in skates, which limit the whole flexion of your foot. The bottom of your feet, you know, every other ancient culture believes in reflexology, healing the body through the nerves in the bottom of the foot. What attention are you paying to that? If you're listening to this and you're like, wow, I haven't done any of those things, it's okay. One of my favorite phrases is, the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is today. So spark that curiosity. Start learning about things like, what is kinesiology? I've never heard that term. Don't be afraid that you don't know what it means. Be curious. Google it. Oh, cool. I got this link. And the cell phone is both good and bad in terms of access to information, but you can go look up some foot mobility exercise. There's a guy out there, knees over toes guy. He's great. Maria Mountain's out there. She'll give you some exercises, but it's just being aware of what you need to match your environment. And once you do that, you'll know you're working on the right path, which is the best thing, as opposed to trying to do CrossFit.
And once again, you're talking about whether it's Ido Portal, and he started with capoeira, yeah, which is the Brazilian martial arts, which we actually bring in a mestra in the summertime to work with our goalies, because it's a little bit of yoga. It's the stretching. It's the capoeira. It's the strength and conditioning. But it's not like back in the day when you were at Princeton and it was all about how much you could bench and how much you could squat. And, you know, so, you know, this has been awesome. We're going to have to, this is so funny. We're just getting started with our podcast and this is the first time I'm saying it. We're going to have you on again, Condo.
Hey, I was going to say, this is going to need a part two, because
I got nothing but time, fellas. I got nothing but time. How much we've changed since Super Skills in Tewksbury doing butterfly pushes across the zone.
Yes. Yeah. Or over at Full Ice with start on one side of the boards and push. Hey, get up and then push all the way back and just grind like that. Like it's funny. We didn't know then what we know now. We're always getting better, and that's how I look at it. And I think you made everybody listening today better, and you made us all think. I'll tell you that much.
No,
not too much though. Not too much.
I can see the smoke coming out of Mercer's ear right now.
I'm buzzing. We pulled the threads, and they sure came out. That's for sure.
That's the not too much though. All right, not too much. Moderation, right? So
Even in moderation,
exactly. So it's just about sparking that curiosity, and then people have the avenues to go and research what interests them. It's just the other caveat is be careful what you read, because we all know the stuff on the internet is fake news. You gotta be careful. So just do your due diligence, and if you don't know, ask.
We will not be pulling on that thread whatsoever. Thanks, Condo.
Thanks, guys. Good seeing you.
I hope you enjoyed the Goalie Podcast by Stop It Goaltending U. If you haven't already downloaded the Stop It Goaltending U app, you can get your free 7-day trial at either the App Store or Google Play.